Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
I'd be totally fine if we just went with a Dropkick Murphys, bumper theme all the way through. It never fails to get you going. I'm Pat Quitelow. It's Tuesday, October 25th. Welcome to the second hour of Up North News. And my guest is Rick Smith of The Rick Smith Show that you hear weeknights on many of these radio stations around Wisconsin. A Teamster truck driver turned radio talk show host. I shouldn't say turned because you're still doing the trucking as well. You've taken a little time off to do a tour of your Midwestern radio affiliates, and we're really glad to have your time here. And you did an event just last night in Oshkosh with the Devil's Advocate crew, didn't you?
Yeah, we were up there with Crute and Dom and having a great time. And I got to tell you, being in Oshkosh, I'm still stunned that Ron Johnson is even anywhere near being electable, given the fact that you've got those jobs that he said there were too many in this state, those union jobs. And he said, no, send those to anti-union South Carolina. I'm still shocked that any working person would vote for this guy.
Same, because when that story came out, when he first said it to a local TV reporter, I remember at the time, I forget if it was February or March, what it was. And it was one of those, where you hear the needle scratch on the record moments and you go, oh, this is not going to go well for him. And yet he continues to have, near 50% support. Mandela Barnes has, 49% support in one of the latest polls. And it's very telling that, you have somebody that is against jobs in his own hometown of Oshkosh that would have come to Oshkosh Corporation to build thousands of Postal Service vehicles, and to let your anti-union prejudice prevent good paying jobs from coming to Wisconsin is something I don't think we can talk about nearly enough, Rick.
No, it should be the lead of every conversation. Every time he opens his mouth, you say, what? We've got enough jobs? Well, tell all those workers that, I saw in, every place that I've gone in this state who are saying, look, we want those good union jobs back. We want that opportunity, that future, that prosperity. And he just said, no, let South Carolina have it.
It's just really telling. But unions in the United States and in Wisconsin, of course, have been taking it on the chin, dating back to, the early days of Reaganomics, if not before, and are only fairly recently making this comeback in oftentimes in smaller places, coffee shops and some other small business chains and things like that. I know that that's not nearly the same as a place that would hire 1,000 workers, but are you encouraged by what you're seeing as more of a new generation of workers understands the benefits of bargaining together instead of one by one?
Yeah, I am. I'm thrilled to see the younger generation saying, look, we need to be a community again. We need to come together, and enough of this hyper-individualism, that there's a benefit in being part of a community. And that's part of what unionism is. It's saying, look, we're going to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. We're going to make sure that nobody falls through the cracks, and we're going to raise up our communities, and we're going to benefit from the fruits of our labor. I mean, this is really what it is. I mean, unions, I get a kick out of when people say, well, your unions put companies out of business because they suck all of them. No, they sit down and say, hey, we create this kind of wealth. We should have a share in it. Not all of it. Not like our shareholder friends who say, no, we want it all. People want to make a living. They want to make sure that their kids get the things that they need, health care, a roof over their head. I don't think that's too much to ask for, Pat. I really don't. And coming out of the pandemic, when all these people are saying, look, you looked at us as patriotic and we were essential and we were heroes. How about we get paid like that? How about we get paid like we matter? And I think that message is coming out of the pandemic, and especially with the younger generation who watched their parents get screwed over for so many years.
I guess I will never completely understand this theory of what I would call the benevolent boss. And again, it's not to paint them all with a broad brush, but to think that, well, better pay and benefits and paid leave and such will come, from the benevolence of my bosses, I mean, naive doesn't even begin to describe that. And yet that's too often the mentality. And if it's not that, then it's this feeling of helplessness. Like, even if I tried to assert myself, we'd all just get fired anyway. And, you know, they're not wrong in that the way laws are written and the way the political climate is, it doesn't make it easy to do this.
No, it doesn't. And this is where we do need comprehensive labor law reform, and have needed it for a very long time. But where I'm encouraged, Pat, is that you're seeing a generation who's internalizing this, saying, look, this is how it should be. And even if you're not a member of a labor union, there are people who still support it. When we start making it cultural again, and I go back to my grandparents' generation, who this was part of their generational identity, when you make it that, I think we will then start to move forward regardless of the laws. I think workers will be far ahead of the laws, as they were in the past. Look, the National Labor Relations Act just didn't come out of the thin air. It came out of all the organizing in the 20s of people in the streets demanding their rights, demanding opportunities. And, you know, I look at the NLRA as a peace accord, really, because there were massive strikes across this country. And this was a government saying, hey, we need to calm this down. I think we could be heading back towards some of that in the future if we don't get some movement.
We reminded our listeners just yesterday was the anniversary of the 40-hour week started on this week in 1940 because of the National Labor Relations Act. That, again, this didn't happen out of any sense of benevolence. It happened when everybody started to look out for themselves in the workplace. We're talking to Rick Smith. We're going to continue the conversation in 2 minutes here about what he's doing in Oshkosh, what he's going to be doing down in Racine and elsewhere on his Midwest tour for his radio show right after this. You're up north.
And traveled many miles, shook a thousand hands.
Hey, we would love for you to check out what we're working on every day. The Up North News newsletter comes out each weekday, and you can sign up for it by clicking newsletter in the top banner at upnorthnewswi.com. While you're got your browser open, open up another tab and go to thericksmithshow.com, where you will learn more about Rick Smith, who joins us now talking about his weeknight radio show and his Midwestern tour. And Rick, we talked about you being in Oshkosh with Dom and Crute and talking about jobs there. What other observations about Oshkosh and where else you've been before we talk about where you're going?
Well, Oshkosh, a lot like many of the cities we've gone to. We are good, hardworking people where, you know, when you talk to them, it's about no-nonsense stuff. How are we going to make better communities? How are we going to get our kids' education? How are we going to move forward? And I think of all the things that I come away with, you know, as we're out talking to people, it's not the divisive stuff that the mainstream corporate-controlled media wants to shove down our throat. It's not the outrage candy that they want us focused on. The people that we're talking to are talking about how do we rebuild community? How do we come back together instead of how to be ripped apart? And as I say all the time, the sooner we can get back together and marching in the same direction, the sooner we can recreate that greatest generation, that working class prosperity of my grandparents' generation. So I'm encouraged by what I'm finding.
Good. One of the things that doesn't encourage me, unfortunately, is that when there are fairly large or noteworthy strikes, there's still plenty of people willing to be the replacement workers and to, you know, set back any progress the workers might be making. That seems to be the case down in Racine, and that's where you're heading next for the CNH folks, Case New Holland, who've been on strike now for about 6 months. And from what I've read about it, this seems like a classic case of a company doing whatever it takes to break the union. I think cutting off their health care on day one of their strike. So what'd you say? It eats up all their strike pay just to maintain health insurance. It's just, there's no sense of, you know, how can we be the best place possible for our workers?
No, but that's the corporate playbook, Pat. I mean, they do this in every scenario. It's all about starving the workforce out. And what I was talking about culture, we're now a culture of hooray for me and screw everybody else. So, of course, you're going to have scabs crossing someone's picket line. You're going to, because nobody understands and feels a sense of community. I think the younger generation gets it, and you see them talking about it. I'm not going to scab on your picket. I'm not going to cross your picket line. And again, I'm hopeful for the future. Right now, yeah, I mean, the sad reality is there is some there's desperation out there, and going to get these people who are going to stab on other people's picket lines, and we have to deal with that. But we've always had that, and what the wealth class has always done is found those divisions. You know, whether it's been white or black or male or female, they've always found a way of tearing us apart. It's these moments where we have to figure out how we come together and help these strikers and help them win one day longer. Because ultimately, we've got to make it that these companies, you know, suffer the consequences financially. You know, if I'm looking at Case New Holland and I'm looking at a new vehicle and a new agricultural piece of machinery, I am not buying anything from them right now because they don't have their best people creating that product. I'll be looking somewhere else. And I think in this next quarter, you're going to see the ramifications of their corporate decisions. And the shareholders may not be all that thrilled.
No, and that's, you know, that's how you would hope some of that pressure can be applied. Taking it to a somewhat of a political level, and I've talked about this on the show here before, trying to remind people that any given entity can walk and chew gum. And in this case, I'm talking about the Democratic Party. And putting it this way, we've heard from people, you know, the press loves to call them the white working class or the Reagan Democrats or what have you. And the common refrain is, well, they used to look out for me, but it seems like now all they're doing is looking out for people in, and then they insert, you know, either culture wars or LGBTQ yeah. populations or whatnot. And seeming to miss the point that you can both be supportive, you can be the better choice for yourself, even as they're giving voice to other groups and fighting for their rights. Fighting for the rights and the voices of others takes nothing away from the proposals and accomplishments they're making on behalf of every other working man and woman.
No, you're absolutely right. But here's the thing. I beat up on Democrats a lot. For their inaction on labor issues. Because understand, I firmly believe Republicans hate working people. Just look at their policies. I don't expect anything but attacks from Republicans. I don't expect anything but no rights at work, attacks on unemployment, attacks on workers' compensation, attacks on Social Security. I expect nothing but that from Republicans. So let me be perfectly clear. I believe Republicans hate working people. That said, Democrats haven't done enough either. You know, I shook Barack Obama's hand twice, and twice he told me, we're going to get the Employee Free Choice Act and better. We got nothing. I voted for Bill Clinton because he said we were going to get strike replacement. We didn't. Jimmy Carter was going to undo Taft-Hartley. That didn't happen. So working people are going, well, what have you actually done since FDR, since the National Labor Relations Act, since the Fair Standards Labor Act? You know, this is time for Democrats to do something. And one of the things I've been advocating for, especially recently, is I want Democrats to propose a piece of legislation that says, you know what? If you're a non-union employee at a plant that's on strike, you should have the right to conscience and not cross a picket line. We should have legislation that's, you know what? You don't want to get involved in it. You can collect unemployment and stay out of it and be protected. We don't have that now. We met a guy in Burlington, Iowa, who was a management kind of employee who said, I can't cross the picket line. And he was fired for it. He was fired for his conscience saying, oh, I don't want to, these are my friends, these are my neighbors, these are my coworkers. I don't want to be in this situation. Get back to the table and hammer something up. But he was fired. He lost his job over it. There should be something that protects him as well as those workers.
That's, you know, when you rattle off the things that should have been done. And I remember as a legislator being just mystified that the Employee Free Choice Act was going nowhere. I understood the, you know, what I was hearing was that, well, we're trying so hard to work on the Affordable Care Act and we can only take on one big thing at a time. Yeah. Okay. I hear what you're saying, but it doesn't get us anywhere.
The Republicans, when they wanted to pass right to work in Kentucky, how long did it take them?
About a hot minute.
It took him 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, if Doug Mastriano becomes governor, how fast do you think Pennsylvania will be a right-to-work state? It will right-to-work? Yes. Next, Democrats need to figure out how to drive the car. When they've got the keys to the car, got to figure out how to drive it and drive it into the issues that make working people's lives better. This is why I think some Democrats, now look, there's the racism, the homophobic nonsense and all the misogyny that comes with some of this. But also, what have you done for me lately? And this is where I think in this moment, Democrats got to lean into what the vision of the future is. rebuilding manufacturing here in this country, rebuilding our infrastructure, and strengthening unions should be what they are hammering on at every opportunity.
It gets then, as I hear people say, well, yeah, they would have done more, but, you know, Manchin and Sinema, it leads to the question of, do you then at least go for the very best thing you can so that it's done and out of the way versus the strategy of spending month after month trying to placate the least controllable Democrats in your caucus, where should they have gone?
And this is where I think, you know, Bernie Sanders had the right idea. You have huge rallies in West Virginia. You bring people into the streets and you make them, you get voters participating again. Democracy is participatory. The more people who are engaged, the more people who are active and in the streets and pushing, I think the better your outcomes can be. I think FDR was the one who said, you want me to do it? Make me. You know, get out in the streets and make me do this. And this is, I think Biden needs that kind of help. Instead of Democrats going, oh, gee, I don't want him to run again in 24. Shut up. Get behind him, move forward, and push these people to do the things that we want them to do. After all, they're not kings and queens. They're our representatives. And as working people, we should be demanding that they represent our interests. And this is one of those big interests.
Rick Smith joins us from The Rick Smith Show, therickssmithshow.com. Heard weeknights on many, if not all, of the radio stations across Civic Media. And he's on a Midwestern tour of affiliates. And so we've talked about Oshkosh, going to Racine. I know eventually you're off to Toledo. Tell us a bit more about the response that you're getting, because it's not every radio host that gets an RV and says, let's go meet our listeners up close and personal.
No, it's been fabulous. In fact, we ended up going to Ottumwa, Iowa, because a listener said, "Hey, you come here. You know, we'll help you find what you need to get people together." And it's just been fabulous. All of the people that we've met and listeners who have come out and shared thoughts. But again, this is something that we have to do more often. And I've been saying this for a very long time. The right does a lot of organizing. You know, if you remember who Ralph Reed was, he was the guy who was the head of the Christian Coalition. Back years ago, they asked him, how did you build what you built? And he pulled out the SWOC handbook, the Steelworkers Organizing Committee's handbook, and said, this is how we did it. Followed labor principles. We got out in the streets. We organized people face to face. And that's why I think things like what we're doing are important and should continue. And we should be expanding this to get out and talk to people. Things like you do, Pat, talking to people on the radio every single day and being part of the community. That's how we re-engage, we reignite, and we reunite this country, not by, you know, going on Twitter and yelling mean things at each other, but getting face-to-face and having real conversations and really connecting.
My goodness, the number of times on this program in the short time we've been on the air that it comes back to conversations. It comes back to talking to people one-on-one and not being afraid to, you know, to maybe start for at a point where you disagree, but, you know, have that conversation where you can find at least some kind of common ground or agree on a shared set of facts. But you're right. We're never going to solve this just by, you know, keyboards. Keyboards and radio microphones are good, but there's no substitute for people getting out of the house and, you know, not just talking about, you know, what reality TV show they watch. These are real issues that folks should be talking about more intimately, frankly.
Yeah, we were in Stevens Point just a couple of days ago and at the Portage County Democratic Party headquarters. And on the window as you walk in, there was a thing that said, rebuild your community. And the number one thing on how to rebuild your community, get out of your house. That was it. Get out and get into the community. And that's what I'm hoping to be able to start doing a little bit here with this tour, is getting people together. I went to a Milwaukee Bucks game the other night. I sat next to a Trump guy, and I'm not quite sure how far right he was. We didn't agree on anything. But in that moment, you know, the game, we were focused on the game. We were talking about that. And some politics got thrown in there as well. But, you know, as I left, I said, look, you know, the reality is we have common interests. If we just take off the red hat or the blue hat, if we just, you know, put down the fence a little bit and really start talking about the future that we all want. And that's kind of what we're hoping out of this tour. Where do we want to go in the future? Because I believe we all want the same stuff.
We all do. And it really comes back to not being afraid to have those conversations, because when it comes right down to it, you know, and, you know, by and large, we have the truth on our side. There was no widespread fraud in the election. They, you know, and eventually people are going to be forced to put up or shut up, and not have anything to say. So yeah, those conversations are just critical. Rick, we got just a couple of seconds left here. So I wanted to thank you any other ways that people should know more about you in the show?
TheRickSmithShow.com. That's where you go to find the website. You can follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show. Make sure you grab the podcast wherever you find your favorites. We are there. And also make sure you tune in every weeknight, 8 to 10 p.m. Here in the state of Wisconsin. We are on every night.
It was so great to meet you in Eau Claire last week. And thanks again for all you do. The camera didn't get out wide enough, but that T-shirt says working class hero for a reason. Rick, thanks so much. Have a great day. Safe travels.
Thank you, brother. Appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you again.
All right. We'll be back after this break. You're up north.
Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
You are listening live to Ron Johnson's Family Vault as we tally up the tax savings that he had from tax breaks that he worked on himself and tax breaks that were given to him by Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature. We'll be talking about that in just a bit. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. It's a Tuesday morning. Happy to have you here. Great to talk to Rick Smith in the first half hour. And in the next half hour, we'll get into this monster corporate tax break and how much it's costing Wisconsin. First, just a quick note that it's 40 in Amory right now, 50 in Richland Center. Let's see, we got 49 in Oshkosh and 44 in Wausau right now. And the rain will eventually move on from west to east across eastern Wisconsin. Much of western Wisconsin is getting back into the sunshine. That what little rain we got hopefully dries quickly so that farmers can continue the harvest. Last I read, the soybean harvest and the potato harvest are both about 75% done. Corn is coming up next, and that is about 4 days behind the average. I'm reading here about 20-25% of the corn's been harvested. So hopefully the dry conditions that are coming up are going to make it easier for our farmers to continue doing the work that feeds us and then some. All right. I have been wanting for a long time to spend some time on what's called the Manufacturing and Agriculture Tax Credit. Again, sounds amazingly harmless. Why wouldn't we have a tax break for our farmers and for our manufacturers? But it is so not that. It is as big a giveaway to the very wealthy and the very biggest businesses as could ever be designed. But cloaked the way that it was, it passed easily. It busted way through budget projections of how much it would cost you and me. And now to the point where we've learned that one of the beneficiaries was Senator Ron Johnson, who once paid six-figure tax bills through his trust fund, but is now paying $0. And it's happened year after year after year. And AJ Byatt-Poor from WKOW-TV is the one who broke the story yesterday. So we wanted to play we're just going to play the full audio of his report so you can hear what he learned and what every Wisconsin taxpayer should hear. And here it comes now. He said, looking at Aaron, cocking an eyebrow. Poor guy's pushing buttons furiously here.
Capitol Bureau Chief AJ Byatt-Poor is digging deeper into what changed and why.
If you cut taxes for everybody, everybody get a tax break, and people that make more money, get more dollars cut, but that's our tax system.
Senator Ron Johnson has never been bashful about his support for tax cuts or his disagreement with the idea they're skewed toward the rich. Democrats feel differently. They see something deeply unfair when they look at state tax records showing the trust fund Johnson set up for his kids paid $0 in state taxes going back to 2016.
We know that the system has been rigged by people like Senator Johnson, for people like Senator Johnson, for way too long.
27 News requested the tax records from the state going back to 2010 when Johnson was elected to the Senate. Shortly after his election, the trust fund bought a million-dollar house in Washington, D.C. Reports later noted Johnson then rented that house while staying in Washington. Between 2011 and 2015, the trust fund had state tax bills ranging between $400,000 and $920,000. Then, it went to zero. The Johnson campaign says it's because of Wisconsin's manufacturing and ag tax credit.
Specifically, our budget...
Former Governor Scott Walker and the Republican-controlled legislature enacted the credit in 2011. The credit took effect in 2013 and scaled up in size each year until 2016, when it reached its current level of 7.5%. That's the same year the trust fund no longer had to pay state taxes. Tax economist Ross Milton says it's not unusual trust funds would also benefit from a tax credit.
More or less the way the trust taxes work is that they are taxed kind of like they're a person. It makes sense then that tax credits like this would apply.
Milton says for taxpayers, when examining policies like the manufacturing and ag credit, which allows the Johnson Trust Fund to save millions of dollars on state taxes, the question is whether those credits created or saved enough jobs to offset the money the government no longer collects.
When you look at people for whom they were paying a lot of state taxes before this policy was created, and then it drops to zero or near zero, you got to think about, well, was that a good investment of taxpayers' money?
Johnson's campaign points to the senator's Democratic opponent, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who's been late on property taxes in the past. An advisor to Johnson writes to 27 News, quote, unable to defend Mandela Barnes' record of tax delinquency, his campaign is now shamefully attacking Senator Johnson's family. It goes on to say, any business or tax entity that Senator Johnson has ever been associated with always has and always will comply with all applicable tax laws. Democrats say it's not a question of whether such tax savings are legal, it's whether they should be.
Even if everything is by the book, it speaks to the frustration that ordinary working families have that the system is set up to work for people like Ron Johnson and his family.
Democrats hope to make the election in part a referendum on how the wealthy are taxed in Wisconsin and across the U.S. Republicans say it's a desperate attempt to deflect. We also obtained the tax records of the Oshkosh Plastics Company Johnson once oversaw. Even after going to the Senate, Johnson owned 5% of Packer up until 2020. The Barnes campaign is flagging how that company also paid no state taxes for the past several years. Like many companies, Packer is a pass-through entity. Now, we explained back on Tax Day how those companies have their taxes directly passed onto the owner's income. So, in our research, we found it is not unusual a company itself has no state tax liability, especially given Wisconsin's manufacturing tax credit.
Andres Guardado, toma el balón.
KOW-TV with a very in-depth story and doing just immense legwork to help viewers and listeners understand what's at play here when a multi-millionaire like Ron Johnson can set up a trust fund, one that, you know, buys a million-dollar house that, you know, he then rents to himself in D.C. And has a company that he sells and passes a tax break that benefits himself and other companies like it, where, again, he can say technically that, yeah, all small businesses benefit from what I'm doing, but it is rigged in such a way that the smallest businesses get just a minuscule amount of benefit simply for the talking point of saying, oh, we're helping all small businesses, when you could have done better by small businesses instead. But of course, as you heard Johnson say in there, well, you know, more money for me means, of course, I'm going to have more tax savings. It doesn't have to be that way if you actually wanted to be a good steward of the tax system. We have been talking about the manufacturing and agriculture tax credit at Up North News, you know, ever since we signed on in January of 2020. It was one of our first big stories about how much it has cost the state in the years since it was enacted. We did an update on it earlier this year because of new figures that were put out by the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau. Now, interestingly enough, we were able to see that memo about the size of the tax giveaway because the memo was requested by the state Senate Republican leader, Devin Lemahieu. He wanted to be able to show off all of the tax policy changes from 2011 when Republicans took over the legislature. Basically, he wanted a brag book to say, look at all the ways that we've lowered taxes or modified taxes. But what he really provided was a roadmap into how much the wrecking ball has come through the way that, you know, Wisconsinites are taxed, or in some of the cases not taxed, to pay for all the essential services that we need. And basically that credit has cost the state close to $3 billion over the decade. The name implies that the benefits go to a wide swath of farmers and manufacturers, but the Wisconsin Budget Project dug into the numbers, and while tax filers with incomes of $1 million or more make up only 0.2% of all the tax filers in the state, and yet somehow they got 76% of the total credit that was out there. 76% of all the millions, now billions, of taxes that were cut went to people with incomes of $1 million or more. And here's the rub: with no proof of job creation required. Seriously, when this was set up, it was said, well, that, again, in that whole trickle-down theory, that, well, they don't have to prove they've created jobs, but if you cut their corporate taxes and the personal taxes of, you know, the millionaires who are executives there, it will just trickle down and lead to more hiring. It has not. It has been studied and found that even companies that were cutting jobs were still getting the tax credit. You know, at the time, let's see, I think it was in 2017, it says here, just 11 of the tax filers who claimed the credit each had income of more than $30 million and each had their taxes reduced by more than $2 million. Now, I'm going to say that again, because again, this is income of $30 million for that particular year. It's not like they have $30 million in wealth. Their income for a year was $30 million. And because of this credit, along with whatever the regular, you know, tax setup is in Wisconsin for them, they received at least $2 million more in cut taxes that you and I then had to make up if we wanted to maintain the same level of services for our schools, for our roads, for our natural resources. Now, the Republicans initially claimed that the manufacturing and agriculture credit would cost the state about $600 million over its first 7 years. $600 million in its first 7 years. Instead, it deprived the state of $1.5 billion by 2019. And then that doubled to $2.8 billion through next year if nothing changes. That, again, based on a study that was done earlier this year, that almost $3 billion will have been lost to Wisconsin services because of this, because of these tax cuts that went primarily and overwhelmingly in terms of dollar amount to the top 1% of Wisconsin taxpayers. And again, while there will be some other tax benefits in that memo that Republicans could talk up, like increasing the standard deduction for couples filing jointly or giving a deduction for some teacher expenses, I mean, that is so small potatoes compared to the cost that we all bear, because huge businesses and the people who run them, like Ron Johnson, are able to avoid paying all manner of taxes that would be useful here in Wisconsin. Now, some Republicans have wanted to take this idea a step further. They just want to eliminate the state income tax altogether. Eliminate the income tax, the most progressive tax, where the wealthier you are, the higher you of a percentage you pay in at certain levels. And instead, Roth and others have talked about eliminating it, meaning that, you know, again, that flat tax they love to talk about. And so I think the lowest tax bracket here is 3.5%, roughly. It would mean that the wealthiest Wisconsinites would also pay 3.5% on all of their income, rather than something close to 7% on the highest section of their income. It's a monster tax break for the very wealthy. Last year, the personal income tax accounted for by far the largest share, 46% of the state's tax income, 46% of the state's tax income, or almost $10 billion, comes from the state income tax. Imagine that being just eliminated. And even if there were some offsets like allowing property taxes to be hiked even more or allowing counties to levy a sales tax, is that really the most fair system? Not even close. We have the most fair system, the most progressive system, the best way for all of us to pay for the services all of us use. And Republicans have dismantled. We'll be back. You're up north. Well, apparently no public education is what, you know, we have far too many politicians saying in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And it's a darn shame in a state like Wisconsin that was a pioneer in free public education. Again, much like we talked about our labor history with Rick Smith earlier this hour, it's so easy to forget the history that led to the comforts that we have today, whether it's, you know, the 40-hour work week or a free public education or the right to choose your own reproductive health care if you're a woman. But in this case of public education, people have forgotten that once upon a time, the only people that really got an education were, you know, the families of nobility, and that everybody else, you know, essentially worked in the coal mines, and there was that sharp divide. And what bridged it, what gave us a middle class, was the notion that every child could get an education and make something more of themselves than their parents. And then couple that with, you know, workplace safety and other reforms that gave us a middle class that flourished in the decades after the Second World War, and then really started a terrible nosedive after a mentality set in that, you know, what's good for business is good for America, when, you know, it should be a much more either cooperative environment or being mindful of, you know, the men and women who are actually doing the work that leads to profit. But it's that anti-worker, anti-education mentality that we've had to deal with here. And at Up North News, we've had several reports or passed along reports and memos from other entities that study the flow of money in and out of Wisconsin schools. And as I was looking at some of our past stories for talking about the manufacturing and agriculture credit, it also, you can't talk about the way that our tax dollars have been diverted away from its intended use without also talking about voucher schools and the way that millions upon millions of dollars that were supposed to go to educating our kids in their local neighborhood public schools has instead gone to schools that are private, maybe religious, maybe for profit, certainly not nearly as accountable. And again, the record is clear that voucher schools do no better than public schools when you look at test scores and other results. Now, at best, they are on par, but they are on par without, you know, nearly the worker protections that teachers get, you know, who were part of a local union, and without, you know, having to take on special education students that public schools have to take on, and so forth. But for 31 years, we've had to deal with this notion of paying. Now it's basically paying for two parallel school systems in Wisconsin. When this all started, it was just a few voucher schools in Milwaukee and then a few more. And then, well, let's do that in Racine too. And next thing you know, it's statewide. The money is being drained away statewide from every public school district. And now you have a Republican candidate for governor in Tim Michaels who wants to take it the rest of the way and provide what he calls universal school choice, but is really what is meant to be the death knell for a free public education at your local school. We wrote a story very early on about how by the time you add up all of the tax cuts and the voucher help and everything else, that our public schools have lost at least $4 billion over a decade as tax money flows to, again, the tax cuts for the wealthy and to private schools. Again, the Wisconsin Budget Project is a Madison-based organization that analyzes the state budgets and tax issues and, you know, just traces all the various ways that the funds that were designed to benefit all of our kids simply are not, because of the way that Republicans since 2011 have structured our finances. Now, you take the last budget cycle, for example, Republicans are out there saying that schools actually got a record amount of state funds. They actually didn't. They got zero. And we've talked about that in the past with the state superintendent of public instruction, Jill Underley. We've also talked about that with Heather Dubois-Bornan, the executive director of the Wisconsin Public Education Network, that it was all a, you know, it was all sleight of hand. It was all a paper trick. You put on paper that you're giving all of this state aid, but you keep the spending restrictions in place that the state has put on school districts, which means that while the money comes to the school district, it has to go right back out the door to property tax relief, which is fine. If you want to give a tax cut, give a tax cut, call it a tax cut. But don't call it an increase in school spending when it is anything but that. You know, each year, Wisconsin taxpayers pay out something like over, you know, $300 million in school vouchers. And that money comes at the expense of public education because it comes from the same pot that funds public and private schools. But the voucher schools get their money out of the pot first. And then what's left is divided among public schools. And then it gets worse, as if that were possible. And again, we've talked about this, but it bears repeating. Private schools, voucher schools, you know, by and large, are not required to take on special education students. They don't take them on to nearly the extent that public schools do, because public schools can't say no. Public schools take them on, and there's an increased cost in that. And that increased cost, of course, comes from the local property taxpayers. Now, the state could help out and say, well, here's the money that we get from the state income tax, which is more fair, and we will offset, you know, some or all of that special education cost. Governor Evers proposed raising that level to 50%, that 50% of the cost of special education borne by school districts would come from the state. Republicans said no. They said, okay, we'll grant you, it's kind of low right now. It's 28% at the time. We'll increase that to 30%. Well, that's still the other 70% comes out of the funds that otherwise would be used for the rest of the school, for general school needs, for, you know, teacher salaries to retain and recruit good teachers. And instead it's going there and continues to do so, even though the state now has a $5 billion surplus. A surplus that could be put to work through a combination of tax cuts and offsetting that special education divide, but Republicans continue to sit on it as part of their 10-month paid vacation and are almost certainly going to use it simply for tax cuts targeting the very wealthy if they control the whole process, if Tim Michaels wins the governorship. Oh, and by the way, that 30% reimbursement for public schools for their special education costs, private voucher schools get reimbursed 90% because of decisions Republicans made in the legislature. We'll have more coming up in our next hour. I'm Pat Wrightlow. You're up north.